Let's go ahead and get started. We have the formal business part of this before we get to the Q and A, and if you'll indulge me with the annual ritual of our governance procedures. Welcome to the 2018 annual shareholders meeting. As many of you know, I'm Jamie Sims, the CFO and the secretary of the corporation. I'm also a member of the board of directors. And as provided for under Article 1, Section 8 of the corporation's bylaws, I will serve as chairman of this meeting as well as secretary. Invitations to the meeting were extended to shareholders of record as of April 30th, certain Vicor employees and certain guests. Each attendee should have registered in the lobby as you entered the building. If any of you have not registered for the meeting, providing your name, contact information, and the number of shares you own, would you please at this time, wherever the list went to, well, it'll appear. Be sure to pick up an agenda, which were left on the seats. As you may have seen upon entering the conference room, we have copies of our 2017 annual report available, and it, of course, is a bound combination of the 10-K and the proxy statement. So, for those of you that have eyeglasses, this is the comprehensive safe harbor statement. We include this in all of our public statements regarding financial or operational performance. I'm not going to recite the full text, but I do remind you, as I do on our earnings calls, that various remarks we may make may constitute forward-looking statements for purposes of the safe harbor provisions under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Statements we may make, including explicit references to technologies, products, customers, opportunities, sales trends, spending, and profitability, are forward-looking statements, Patrizio, yes, involving risks and uncertainties. In light of these risks and uncertainties, we are discussed, at which are discussed in our most recent 10-K, we can offer no assurance that any forward-looking statement will, in fact, prove to be correct. Consistent with NASDAQ Listing Rule 5620, shareholders are afforded the opportunity to discuss company affairs with management at this meeting. However, as shown on the screen, Vicor is in its quiet period for the second quarter of 2018, and as such, we will not comment on specific elements of financial or operational performance for the second quarter or any forward period. Second quarter performance will be addressed during our upcoming earnings call, which we anticipate will be taking place on Tuesday, July 24th. To the formal part of the agenda, as shown, we'll conduct the business meeting reviewing the single proposal before stockholders, as well as any business that may be brought before the meeting. As of now, I am unaware of any such additional business. After we take care of the formal business, Patrizio will take your questions. Again, he cannot answer and will not answer questions regarding our financial or operating performance for the second quarter. I also caution you, Patrizio will not be responding to questions regarding patent litigation. Information about the status of legal matters can be found in the company's filings with the SEC. As is the case in the past, we'll be posting an audio recording of today's business meeting and subsequent Q&A on the IR page of our website. So my nine fellow members of the board of directors are Patrizio, chairman, president, and CEO, who founded the company in 1981. Claudio Tuzzolo, whose title recently changed to president of the company's Vicor Power Components unit. Claudio has been a director since 2007 and with the company since 2001, and yours truly. Sam Anderson, who is the CEO of Icemos Technology Limited, a supplier of thick film bonded SOI wafers based in Belfast. Sam is the former CEO of Great Wall Semiconductor, an important component supplier to Vicor, in which we held an investment in non-voting convertible preferred. Great Wall was acquired in 2015 by Intersil. Alan Henderson, who was appointed to the board in 2014 upon his retirement for Vicor after 3 decades leading the company's Westcor division, which was based in Sunnyvale, California. And then Barry Kelleher, who retired at the end of 2016 as president of our brick business unit, which is now the primary element of our Vicor Power Systems unit. Barry had been an employee director from 1999 and joined Vicor in 1993. In alphabetical order, our independent directors are Jason Carlson, CEO of Congatec AG, which is headquartered in Deggendorf, I hope I got that right, outside of Munich, Germany. Congatec is a leader in industrial embedded computing. Jason chairs both our audit committee and our compensation committee. Estia Eichen is an original investor in the company, having known Patricio since the 70s when they were both research fellows. And since 1989, a senior scientist, he has been a senior scientist at the Fermi Lab outside of Chicago. Liam Griffin is CEO and director of Skyworks Solutions and has been since May 2015. Liam's been the architect of that company's strategy, creating a leader in mobile communications. He joined our board in 2009 and also serves on our audit and compensation committees. We're joined today by outside counsel, Gabor Garai. And thank you, Gabor, for the space and venue. Gabor chairs the private equity and venture capital practice here at the firm. Also in attendance is Ed Sullivan, our audit partner from KPMG, our independent registered public accounting firm. Finally, I recognize Dan Glennon, representing ComputerShare Trust Company, the corporation's transfer agent, who has been appointed to act as inspector of election, also known as the teller, for the formal business portion of the meeting. So thank you, everyone, for attending. So I call the annual meeting to order. This is our agenda for the formal portion of the meeting. Notice of the meeting was sent to all stockholders as of record, close of business on April 30th, the record date. Only stockholders of record on that date are entitled to vote at this meeting, either by proxy or by in-person ballot. Similarly, only stockholders of record are entitled to present proposals during the business portion of the meeting. The affidavit of mailing of the notice of meeting has been delivered to the teller by me and will be filed with the minutes of today's meeting. The proxy statement was filed on the 30th of April and mailed shortly thereafter, and it sets forth the sole proposal for voting on today. Fortunately, we'll keep this short. And it involves recommending a recommendation by the board to vote in favor of the proposal for 9 directors, the incumbent directors. Rule 14A8 under the Exchange Act provides for the inclusion of our proxy statement of appropriately submitted proposals from eligible shareholders. I, in my capacity as secretary, confirm we did not receive any such proposals to be included in our proxy statement. This slide sets forth the number of shares of common stock and shares of Class B stock as of the prior 2 year ends and the record date of April 30th. These figures are presented on a basic basis, reflecting only the shares eligible to vote. Said another way, the dilutive impact of any options exercisable within 60 days of the date shown has been excluded. So as shown, as of the record date, our outstanding shares consisted of 27,840,233 shares of common stock and 11,758,218 shares of Class B. I remind you that our Class B shares possess 10 votes per share, although they are exchangeable only on a one-for-one basis for shares of common stock. As shown, holders of our Class B shares, of which there are 13, possess, as of the record date, 80.9% of the cumulative voting power of the 145,422,413 shares eligible as of the record date. Also, as of the record date, on a basic share basis, Dr. Vinciarelli owned 35.4% of common stock shares outstanding and 93.8% of Class B shares outstanding, representing in sum 82.6% of total voting power, giving him control over all governance matters. On a fully converted basis, Dr. Vinciarelli's holdings represented 52.7% of total share ownership. Because of this voting control under corporate governance requirements of NASDAQ Rule 5600, we are considered a controlled company, which is defined as a listed entity for which more than 50% of the voting power for the election of directors is held by an individual or an identified group. As such, we rely on the exemptions set forth in Rule 5615 from Rule 5605, which requires a majority of directors be independent, and which requires the nominating process be the sole responsibility of independent directors. We do not utilize the available exemption from independent director oversight of executive compensation, but instead have a compensation committee comprised solely of independent directors. Of course, there is no exemption from maintaining an audit committee composed solely of independent directors, which we do. Directors Carlson, Eichten, and Griffin are considered independent and will be the sole members of the board's compensation and audit committees for the 2018 term. So returning to procedure, our first order of business should be to determine whether the shares represented at the meeting, either in person or by proxy, are sufficient to constitute a quorum for the purpose of transacting business. I introduced Dan earlier. Dan has been appointed to serve as Inspector of Election, having pledged to perform his duties under the General Corporation Laws of Delaware to support me in the conduct of this meeting. His pledge will be filed with the minutes and records of this meeting. Are there shareholders in attendance who have not submitted a proxy but wish to vote in person? If so, please raise your hand so that Dan may confirm your eligibility. Stockholders present should be aware, for purposes of preparing the slides used today, we have assumed those who have signed and submitted a proxy, even though present, intend to vote by that proxy. However, are there any stockholders who previously submitted a proxy who would like to change their vote on any matter before stockholders? Seeing none, I now ask Dan, in his capacity as teller, to inform us whether a quorum is present.
Mr. Chairman, I can report, as of the record date, April 30th, 2018, 27,840,233 shares of common stock and 11,758,218 shares of Class B stock were outstanding, representing an eligible total of 145,422,413 possible votes, as shown on your slide. Given our receipt of Dr. Vinciarelli's proxy representing 82.6% of eligible votes, far more than the simple majority of eligible votes required for a quorum, are represented here today. As you have just seen, I have received no new ballots nor any instruction to withdraw or change an existing proxy, so the numbers previously reported and shown on your slide are accurate. As of the record date, Vicor had 133 holders of common stock defined as held of record under Rule 12G5-1 of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, representing the sum of stockholders identified by Computershare as distinct holders in possession of their shares, or stockholders whose shares are held by a custodian for single account. A complete list of stockholders as of the record date, compiled and certified by Computershare, is open for examination at this meeting by any stockholder.
Thank you, Dan. I therefore declare a quorum. The polls are now open and will remain open until the matters before the meeting have been presented and the teller confirms no votes have been cast other than those received by prior proxy. So the sole proposal was to fix the number of directors at 9 and to elect the 9 incumbents. Since the proposal was addressed in detail in the proxy statement, and since 94.4% of shares eligible to vote are represented by proxy here, we will dispense with the formal motions and balloting for the proposal. Further, as Dan mentioned, Dr. Vinciarelli's proxy representing 82.6% of eligible votes has been received and voted in favor of each of the proposals. Therefore, the proposal received prior to today's meeting more than enough votes for approval. In order to provide you with an opportunity to discuss, I'll briefly describe the proposal, but it is the 9 incumbents and no changes to the board. The board, which acts as a whole when considering the composition and size of the board, has concluded the three incumbent independent directors appropriately meet the requirements of NASDAQ rules 5605B and D for audit and compensation committees, respectively, to be made up solely of independent directors, three in the case of the audit committee and two under rules in the case of the compensation committee. As such, the board has voted to recommend to stockholders the number of directors for the 2018 term be maintained at 9 and the 9 incumbent directors be reelected. Each stockholder was entitled to vote for a maximum of 9 nominees, and cumulative voting was not permitted. Is there any further discussion of the only proposal before shareholders? There being no further discussion regarding, I ask whether there are any other matters to be brought properly before the meeting by an eligible shareholder. Hearing none, I will once more ask if there is a stockholder who has not cast a ballot who now wishes to do so, or is there a stockholder who has not yet had his or her ballot collected? Appearing to be none, I now formally close the polls. Based on the vote totals previously provided by Computershare and seeing no additional votes reported by the teller, I am pleased to report that the 9 directors received an affirmative vote of at least 97.4% of the total amount of votes cast, representing at least 91.8% of those entitled. Final results of today's ballot will be reported in detail on or before Wednesday the 20th via filing with an 8K. There being no other business before the meeting, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Thank you. All in favor of adjourning, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Vote is in favor of adjournment. This concludes the formal portion of the meeting. At this time, Patricio will take your questions. Once again, I remind everyone we are in a Q2 quiet period, and accordingly, Patricio will not be commenting on current performance. I also remind you, as chairman of the meeting, I'll be following the rules of conduct that were distributed to attendees, the note on your seat. I repeat the invitation for interested parties to participate in our upcoming quarterly conference calls. Patricio.
Thank you. Good morning. First question. Please go ahead.
Quick question on the update on the capacity expansion.
Yeah, so we're looking at land in New Hampshire. We're getting some proposals. I think, as I mentioned at the last quarterly call, we have significant opportunity for capacity expansion within our existing primary factory in Andover. We have 250,000 square feet of manufacturing space there. And we believe we can expand capacity to the $500 million level. So we're looking at additional land and a first building, potentially with the opportunity to further expand within a parcel is large enough to accommodate at least 250, possibly as much as 500,000 square feet of incremental space. But we're not pursuing this with a sense of urgency because of, again, the opportunity to expand capacity within the existing facility and the productivity improvements that will derive from expanding capacity without taking on additional fixed costs. So the time frame, generally speaking, for completing the acquisition of the land and then putting a facility and outfitting it with equipment is, I think, of the order of 12 months or thereabouts. And we have time to plan that and execute it without diverting focus from the mission at hand, which in the short term is expanding capacity within the existing facility.
And just to follow on the contract manufacturer you hired, what percentage of output are they taking? Say, if you could do 500 million in Andover, what would they be a part of that?
Yeah, so to be clear, we have not contract manufactured any one of our products. We have entered into, you know, a partnership with a subcontractor for some of the process steps that are involved in these kinds of products, particularly, you know, the golden plating steps that are involved in taking a panel, which we manufacture in Andover, and giving it the features that are necessary for interconnecting it to motherboards or within semiconductor packages. So this a facility is not that far away from our Andover manufacturing facility. It is now beginning to, I would say, transition into actual production, having gone through some test runs. We have another vendor that has been providing the services. So this is a set of process steps that are part of the manufacturing, total manufacturing process, for which we've had one vendor, and for which we're soon going to have a second, you know, more capable, I would say, vendor with a lot more capacity, a lot more cost effective, and we're looking forward to turning it on actually in the next few weeks. Please go ahead.
I've asked in the past about the size of the segments of the markets that you serve, and you've spoken about the extensive opportunity, and that is your foremost focus. Instead of determining the size of those markets, which is difficult to do, My question is, how is your view of the size of the segments of the markets you serve changed over the last year?
Well, I think that the opportunity continues to expand, both within those market segments that we have been addressing, and within new market segments that we're beginning to address. And it is expanding in a complement of ways that are worth noting. It's not just expanding for power package solutions such as the one pictured here, let's say within the data center space, or with artificial intelligence applications in a variety of end markets. But importantly, it is beginning to expand significantly with a complementary power conversion task, which is in the front end, so to speak, converting power from primarily the AC mains, single phase, three phase, electrical power mains worldwide, into the 48 volt bus, which is the hub from which the point of load devices operate. So I think it's worth reflecting on that for a minute because it's very significant. The revenues and revenue growth has been coming from point of load solutions, specifically solutions that, let's say, in the case of the data center application, have powered the Intel processors, and solutions that have distinguished themselves by enabling more efficient powering of Intel processors with more dense devices that dissipate less heat, and which draw their power from a 48-volt infrastructure that is available in certain data centers by certain data center customers. That 48 volt power delivered within a rack, and a large multiplicity of racks, as you can imagine, in data centers that literally consume megawatts of power, historically and to this day, has been sourced from other suppliers, and typically sourced within very bulky front ends that take typically three-phase power, AC power, and convert it to 48 volt. Now, as of today, the majority of data centers still runs on 12 volt infrastructure. There is now a definite phase transition beginning to take place from 12 volt to 48 volt. Google was a pioneer in this area and announced that Open Compute about a year and a half ago, their adoption of 48 volt infrastructure and the 30% savings in power consumption that were derived from that. But the industry at large has not yet affected the transition from 12 volt to 48 volt. And I'm still staying focused on, in effect, what is happening at the point of load, you know, whether that point of load power is derived from 12 to 48. But whether it's 12 or 48, the front end systems that deliver the 12 volt or 48 volt power and being provided by other traditional power suppliers with very bulky, again, infrastructure. We're now beginning to see a transition, not only from 12 to 48, but when we get to 48, to solutions that are holistically addressed by our power conversion building blocks. To be more specific, where we provide the entire chain of power conversion building blocks from the AC mains all the way to the point of load. The benefits of that have to do with, in effect, extending the advances in power density from point of load devices to front ends with more dense, more efficient, and more flexible solutions. So all of these developments are expanding a market opportunity. And to recap, the extension comes from converting at the point of load from a 48 volt infrastructure that Google in particular has installed in its data center starting about 6-7 years ago. More data center customers converting to 48 volt, which is in effect a hub that makes our solutions, you know, particularly attractive. And importantly, also beginning to provide delivery of power at the 48 volt node from 3 volt sources. You might have seen on our website, so the first example of that, by a Japanese company called Pezin, which has made supercomputing boxes. They're really liquid-cooled tanks, which contain a large multiplicity of CPUs, powered by these kinds of devices, the ones on the screen, but also notably powered by RFM, which takes in three-phase 200 volt AC power and converts it to the 48 volt bus, which is distributed internally within segments of those tanks. Each tank is about 250 kilowatts. And there's a large multiplicity of these kinds of tanks. Sometimes a system can be 3 megawatts worth of power. Okay. So not only does the 3 megawatts ultimately, or most of it ultimately, lands at the point of load by way of these kinds of devices, but to get there, it's got to make a stop at the hub, which happens to be 48 volt. And getting it there with the RFM is part of our solution in the PSC supercomputing system. Week after next, I'm visiting three companies in Texas. Each of these companies is interested in the RFM as a means to go to 48 volt, as a means to go to the point of load with denser solutions that require, in effect, the kinds of capabilities that we can uniquely provide through our building block methodology to power systems. Sorry for the length of the response, but it's there are many facets to that question. Please go ahead.
If you had mentioned the fourth generation of technology and how you're working on that, could you give some explanation on the benefits of that, on size, efficiency, density, and how that would affect your product lines and how that rolls out?
So it's beginning to roll out. We've taken on commitments with some key customers for initial delivery of systems that contain our 4G control capability starting late this year. It will fully roll out through the first half of next year. It brings with it significant advances in terms of density, efficiency, and cost effectiveness. So case in point, with respect to the regulator part of a system, it can reduce power dissipation relative to our existing 3G technology by a third to, under certain operating conditions, as much as one half, meaning under certain operating conditions, the amount of heat that is generated with a 4G regulator can be half of what it was with, or it is, with the 3G regulator. And that's very significant, not just because of the, you know, efficiency improvements, which are important in their own right, but it's significant because of the total value proposition and the interdependency that has with the cost structure of our product. Just look at this, and it's coincidentally a good choice of a slide. And you can envision here what we call a panel, and there is a multiplicity. It looks like it's about maybe 32 chips that get singulated out of the panel after the panel is processed through its manufacturing steps. These individual devices are capable of processing a certain amount of power. Now, imagine the effect of being able to cap the heat that they generate by a factor of two. Well, the first order impact of that is that you can shrink them in size because most of our products are, in effect, limited by thermal performance, meaning you can only extract so much heat per square centimeter or square inch out of a device. But if you cap the amount of heat in half, you can cap the size of the device in half and still have the same heat density, that is, the same amount of heat per unit area. But what have you accomplished in the process? Well, you can get twice as many. And first order, it means the cost of the device is cut in half. And the impact of that is being able to sell a lot more than twice of them. So the net effect of the advances in performance that brought about by next generation silicon are very significant, not just in terms of performance, but the impact on the cost structure and the competitiveness of our products. So going back to your question, so-called 4G PRM is on our bench being tested with validation of the advances in performance that we had targeted. there is a second major component to this, which is the 4G VTM controller. That is tapping out next week. We should be seeing first samples in a couple of months, 2 or 3 months. And we expect to be able to start demonstrating solutions that involve the 4G VTM controller by the second quarter of 2019. There too, as with the 4G PRM, we're going to be able to, in some cases, achieve increases in efficiency under certain operating conditions. These are not improvements that apply under all operating conditions, to be sure, but under certain operating conditions, the loss will be cut, again, by something like a factor of two. So customers really appreciate these continuing advances. I think some customers, I know, have made the choice of factorized power using, you know, Vicor building blocks, in part because of the promise of continuing advances. They're, in effect, making a strategic choice that is driven in part by the continuing path to performance improvement and cost reduction that our technology, young as it is, brings about. The competitive technology has been at it for a long time. It is it's been refined, keeps getting better, but as you can imagine, with something that the industry has relied upon for literally decades, it is getting close to the end of its road. And it's getting close to the end of its road because it's architecturally limited. It cannot, at the same time, provide efficient power distribution to get power from point A to point B, while at the same time, point B being the point of load, being able to efficiently convert power at the point of load. The silicon there too keeps getting better, and the large multiplicity of companies competing with each other in that space keep, you know, inching ahead in terms of the relative performance attributes. But ultimately, it's an approach that is really rooted on a 12-volt infrastructure that, for a variety of reasons, is getting superseded by the 48-volt infrastructure that we have pioneered. And that's been the case in the data center space. I think it's going to be soon the case in automotive. I think going back to your core question of the continuing generational advances in technology, you know, our serial integration roadmap is very much focused on making the most out of these new capabilities. Please.
Could I go back to the addressable market for a second? In the 10K, you provided, you know, a numerical estimate for the current markets. Could you give us the same kind of numerical estimates for what you foresee down the road in, say, 5 years? And you can do that in a range. I'm trying to pin you down, but what the possibilities are.
I'm going to probably not surprise you, but repeating things I've said in the past, that to a high degree, the size of the overall market is such that, you know, for quite some time, it doesn't really pose any meaningful constraint to our growth. It isn't limited by the size of the market. Let me approach it in a slightly different way. You know, we have customers we do $50 million a year of business with. I think we are aware of customers where their level of business could grow by nearly an order of magnitude with just one customer over another 3 to 5 years. Those kinds of opportunities underscore the fact that our limitation, it doesn't come from the size of the market in the data center space or eventually in automotive. They're huge markets. Automotive is a lot larger than data center. It is a limitation that comes from other constraints. I think the kinds of constraints that are to do with the enterprise, its ability to expand its operations, its ability to reach out to a growing base of customers, its ability to earn the confidence of these customers that in effect bet their solution on a company for products that have really no equivalent alternative. Those are the limiting factors more than the size of the market. So I frankly don't pay a lot of attention to the market size at large. And to be perfectly honest with you, you've read something that I haven't read with respect to the numbers that made it to print. Not because I don't care, but because I'm really not concerned about the size of the market. You know, ultimately, the power system market at large, and our strategy, even though from time to time it appears to be narrowly focused on particular end markets, our strategy supported by the power component methodology, you know, what we're doing with silicon integration to facilitate these kinds of a Lego approach, if you will, a building block approach to power system, is such that, and this is perhaps the most significant opportunity for the company, is such that we can really uniquely address power system requirements at large. And as I was suggesting earlier, I see this starting to happen. I think the application with the Japanese customer was a pioneering application in that regard, and I see that happening with much larger customers over the next several years.
This was on page 7, and it did identify $1 billion as in the 10K, $1 billion for what you call the merchant market, and $3 billion right now in the DC-DC portion of the merchant market. But what I was hoping to get to was to, you know, if you were writing the same thing.
I didn't write that.
I understand that. So I can tell the answer I'm going to get already, but I can still go on with the question. If I was looking at the 10K 5 years from now, and it had that same kind of statement in there, you know, what would you think it might, how do you think it might compare?
You're trying to pin me down on
that. That's why I said I was very, very happy with it, a range.
Again, some of those numbers, even though I wasn't involved in setting those particular benchmarks, I believe are predicated on particular classes of opportunity in certain end markets. What I think they miss is the greater opportunity of addressing power systems from the AC to the point of load in markets that are quite large, larger than the ones we've been serving of late. And I see the kinds of solutions that we are providing as, particularly as realized through our 4G technology, which greatly expands the capability in terms of, in particular, AC solutions. I see that as the power system capability that electronic systems at large require going forward. The way, you know, power is being processed and the methodology for bringing about power system solutions is really antiquated and not efficient and not scalable. And all of that is bound to change. Vicor has a unique position to bring about that change, facilitate it, and benefit from it. And the market size at large. I mean, look at it this way. One measure that I'm fond of, you should interpret this percentage as an average that from application to application could differ easily by a factor of 3. But 3% is a good average number for the value of a power system within an electronic system at large. In some instances, it could be higher. In some other instances, it could be lower by, you know, a large factor. It could be 1%, it could be 5 or 6%. But if you look at the electronics industry as a whole and take a few percent, that's a number that's far, far greater than a few billion dollars. And ultimately, that is the market opportunity because to a high degree, whether, you know, we're powering within a package an AI ASIC or, you know, Intel CPU or a communication device in some other setting, the issues are very much the same. You know, ultimately, they boil down to Commodore and Meadow requirements for efficiency, density, cost effectiveness, scalability. You know, fundamentally, the power system cannot be the obstacle to the delivery of the solution, whatever the solution needs to be, whether it's computing power or communications or, you know, mobility or autonomous driving. You know, the power system should be the tail wagging the dog, not getting in the way of trampling the dog. And very often, that's not the case because of the fact that power conversion technology, while continuing to advance, hasn't really gotten to the level of scalability that would be appropriate. It has happened in other parts of the electronics industry. It hasn't happened yet in power conversion, and it's bound to happen. And we believe we have the strategy, the technology, you know, the intellectual property. In this technology, we've invested a few hundred million dollars. We got 150 patents. And this came about because we've held for a long time a clear view of where the industry would need to get. You know, I don't see that anywhere else. I think obviously there are companies that are doing very well with tunnel vision with respect to certain pockets of opportunity, but I haven't seen any evidence of any grand vision to address power systems at large, again, from the wall plug. And the wall plug can be, you know, a 110-volt outlet only capable of 1 kilowatt, or it can be tens of kilowatts or megawatts for a very large computing system. There isn't a company out there that has, from what I can tell, the ingredients that are necessary to address those opportunities. And I expect that this change is going to come about because it's necessary not to hold back advances that are taking place in other areas. Please.
My question's a quality assurance question, and I'll preface it by saying that I know little about your manufacturing technology. Hmm. As your volume is growing, are you finding that you need to do, or will you be doing things differently with your third-party vendors or in your own processes to assure that same level of quality?
Quality is, to your point, mission critical. We deal with customers that have very, very high expectations in terms of our quality act. So I can tell you, for instance, that the quality of our products, devices such as this, get measured in terms of failure rates over a lifetime of many years in a data center in parts per million, meaning our failure rate could be 7 parts per million, which means for a million devices that we ship over an installed lifetime of several years before the equipment gets overhauled by the next generation of equipment, we may have 7 failures out of a million devices installed. These kinds of standards of quality, you know, obviously very stringent. They don't come about accidentally. It takes a mindset and a methodology that encompasses the entire enterprise. It takes process control and a focus, not just to your point in the internal process, but also very importantly in the pipeline upstream to us with our vendors and their capabilities. And by the way, the reference I made earlier with respect to you know, the plating process used in making our SM chips as pictured here, you know, you might have noted that I made reference to the fact that the new vendor, in addition to being a lot more cost-effective, as scalability and quality capabilities go beyond the existing vendor. So we're very focused on our quality act. I think it's reflected in our internal yields. So for devices such as this, after they're introduced to the manufacturing process that released to mass production, we achieve yields typically of 97, 98, sometimes 98.5%, meaning for every 100 we make, you know, we get to ship 98. So the defect rate in the manufacturing process is very low. It is low to your point because we make the products with good internal process control, but other components from reputable vendors that we have developed relationships with, whose quality act we very much monitor and appropriately rely upon. So we're very mindful of the fact that a quality snafu would be costly. It's not something that has happened or we expect to have happened. I'm not suggesting that in the 30 years or nearly 40 years of the history of the company, that there was never a quality issue. Every company from time to time has some, but we've been remarkably good at avoiding and limiting the significance. And I would say that in general, our quality act has kept getting better and better because the enterprise has matured, and you know, this philosophy is ingrained in the minds and the actions of all the key people that you know, are responsible for controlling these processes. I think I'll take first the question from.
Yeah, I read your risk factors from 2016.
Yeah.
I read your risk factors on the 2017, and they're one and the same. So my question to you is, given the turbulence with the United States and the world, what keeps you up at night? What are the true risk factors of being able to accomplish what you're talking about?
Other than a couple of glasses of wine the night before. not much, really. You know, so with respect to you know, what is going on in terms of tariffs and potential trade wars, we don't really have significant exposure. The ZTE, a customer, but very tangled fraction of 1%. So there isn't any real concern with respect to direct impact on our growth coming from the current environment. I'm careful to say direct because obviously indirectly, if a trade war were to erupt and it had a significant impact on the economy, that would obviously affect all of us. But this is nothing that really keeps me up at night. I would say that both in terms of our supply chain with our own components and our customers purchasing components from us directly, there isn't any significant exposure. I think there was maybe one question from the back before we get back to you.
First of all, thank you. It's been a really nice year, and I want to thank you for running a company the way I think a company should be run, by investing in R&D, mm-hmm. no financial shenanigans, and sticking to your knitting. It's really refreshing to see, and it's really nice to see that we're seeing the results now. So I've got a two-part question on the NVMs. The first one, I'm just wondering, is it more of an enabling technology, or is it more of a technology that will be selling more of your power on packages? And then the second part of that question is, are your customers, let's say a GPU customer, using the NVM, let's say the 12 to 48 volt NVM, to provide an ordering option so they can order their GPUs with a for a 12 volt server or a 48 volt server? Is that what's happening with those?
So with the GPU customer, there was, as with Google before, obviously a gutsy decision to transition to 48 volt. I would say gutsy, but reasoned and strategically important. In view of what the data center space of today is and where those kinds of GPUs primarily sell over the next couple of years. There, the word gutsy is appropriate because, as suggested earlier, the lion's share of the data center infrastructure is still 12 volt. Right. So imagine as a GPU vendor, leading GPU maker, going to your customers in the data center space who have a 12 volt infrastructure and telling them, I got great news for you. We got this new super duper GPU, but now you got to plug it into 48 volt. I can speculate as to the strategic reasons behind it, other than the enabling a level of performance by the GPU that would not be possible with the 12 volt system. So they do have an answer to the customer asking, why are you doing this to me? I got 12 volt and you're coming in with a 48 volt solution. Well, we're delivering you a lot better performance. I think the answer ultimately has to do, and I want to underscore the fact that this is my personal sense of things, and it's not, I'm not disclosing anything that has been given to me. I'm not reflecting the views of that company. This is just my hunch. I think part of the logic of going to 48 volt is what is going to happen in the automotive space, which is a much larger market than the data center market. I think it's no mystery that automotive electronics will finally migrate to a more efficient 48-volt infrastructure away from the long-standing dominance on 12-volt. And that's where a lot of GPUs and, you know, other AI chips are going to be sold. So it's a timely decision in terms of, you know, anticipating a better fit in a different market space. So to your point, where does the NBM come into this? It's a very dense, efficient, and cost-effective building block that provides for the ability to use a 48-volt solution in a 12-volt infrastructure, and importantly, use a 12-volt solution in a 48-volt infrastructure. And both of those are key to you know, providing the level of flexibility that is needed in order to make these transitions happen. So let me be a little bit more specific with respect to this. Let's say that a Google competitor in the center space has been thinking for many years about what Google has done, the benefits that they have achieved and advertised, but reluctant to make that step because of their culture being more conservative, not wanting to be on the leading or bleeding edge of development, not wanting to be single source dependent on you know, relatively small companies such as Vigor. An NBM can essentially address what otherwise would be an agonizing choice, right? Because you can, as a company that's relied on 12 volt, make a change to 48, use devices like an NBM converting power from 48 to 12, and still rely on old-fashioned, traditional 12 volt point-of-load solutions that compete with our products. So to be clear with respect to that, everybody acknowledges the power distribution benefits and efficiency benefits, eliminating 12-volt bus bars carrying you know, thousands of amperes, you know, going down to much smaller wires with 48-volt infrastructure. But there's reluctance to take that step because of a concern of getting stuck with a more limited choice of vendors that can then take that 48 volt and process it to power, you know, Intel CPUs in particular. Well, with an NBM, you can take advantage of the infrastructural benefits and still rely on your old multi-phase 12 to the point of load. But the NBM also is a bidirectional device, can convert from 12 to 48. So it can, in the short term, enable a data center with 12-volt racks to use NVIDIA GPUs that run on 48. It wouldn't be NVIDIA providing that solution. It would be the likes of Microsoft, Amazon, and others outfitting their rack with these small building blocks to be able to plug in the latest and greatest GPUs. And as you can imagine, there is a strong motivation to be able to do that, right? Nobody would not want to take advantage of the computational capability of the state-of-the-art devices. So I think an important observation is the following. Google's adoption of a 48-volt infrastructure was pioneering. It caused many companies in that space to take notice of this change, but it didn't bring about a sea change, because in decisions by Google's competitors were not in effect in any way forced by Google's action. When it comes to components like state-of-the-art GPUs, it's a different story, because now it's a key building block that needs to be able to operate in a 12-volt infrastructure. So that's where the NBN comes in. It allows it to operate in a 12-volt infrastructure. So it makes it possible, without changing the infrastructure, to operate the latest and greatest devices that run on 48. But it also, before too long, I think it will make it a lot easier to make the change. And we're seeing this. This is happening. My three visits come Sunday evening, next week, Monday and Tuesday. They're all about this kind of a change.
So NVIDIA is actually not providing it. The other guys are going to have to buy it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Please.
To follow up on automotive, the two questions. One is, what is your exposure on a Waymo-powered automotive? The other one is, I remember reading an article on the autonomous vehicles where it was saying that there's a lot of good 12-volt systems in there for whatever reason. Why do you need to change that and make a mixture of 12 and 48? Is that the case? And would the NVM also fit into that scenario?
Yeah, that's an insightful question as well. We power the most advanced autonomous driving system, which is Waymo's, Google's system. And we power it with something that's called a power strip. The power strip is, as the word suggests, a device about 1 foot long. It's about an inch wide and a little over half an inch thick. It contains 10 of these kinds of devices, as well as two larger devices. It operates from high voltage bus. It's typically found in these kinds of automotive system. And it provides as many as 10 different outputs to power CPUs, LIDARs, a variety of sensor and computing systems that are part and parcel of a very sophisticated autonomous driving system. So I drive a Tesla, and Elon Musk had that system, the autonomous driving system, called an autopilot. I think we've all read that was a bit of an overstatement, even though it will drive itself on 93 without much of a concern. If you were to take it into downtown Boston and let it do its thing, you wouldn't be going for more than a quarter of a mile, right, without doing something terrible. And that's because in a Tesla Model S, there is probably $300 or $400 worth of sensors, a few hundred dollars worth of sensors. And so that system, from its conception, is not designed to be the kind of level four type of system that is truly autonomous driving. In a Waymo car, there is tens of thousands of dollars worth of hardware, including very elaborate sensing and great computing capability to deal with the real world of dogs running in the middle of the street or a kid or the complex environment of truly autonomous driving. So what our PowerSleep does, it provides a complement of outputs to enable evolution of these various sensing systems that historically have been operated from 12 volt, but now again are evolving to 48 volt. So our building blocks, our chips, are flexible. They put out 12 volt, they put out 48 volt. You can actually program and reprogram them to get any output you want. You can get as many as 10 different outputs, or you can gang them together to get a more powerful output at any voltage. And it's a dense solution, it's a very efficient solution, it's a very cost-effective solution. Now, obviously, over time, higher level of integration here, too, is going to bring about more efficient systems that consume as much power. In particular, in that solution, there is several kilowatts worth of power consumption to afford the level of visibility and intelligence that is required, therefore, for safe autonomous driving. Over time, that budget is going to come down. The business model is going to start with the $50,000 or so worth of hardware being deployed in as a service within a car that is not just used for an hour a day, so as to justify the depreciation of that level of hardware investment. But over time, this is going to become lower cost, higher density. It's going to, get lost in the space of a plate, and the power consumption is going to go down. And I think the power consumption is all going to be at 48 volt. So that's an important market for us. We have, I think we're well aligned with the leader, the absolute leader in that space, a company that got started many, many years ahead of the pack. I think we're within a year and a half or two of that market opportunity, and we were talking earlier about the size of market opportunities. That market opportunity will become very, very significant. We're looking, we'll be looking at volumes of hundreds of cars, right? And it's going to get into tens of thousands of cars in the next year and a half. And the value proposition gets to be pretty significant. Go ahead.
You've spoken in the past with rational flexibility about the future of PiCor and where it may go in order to thrive and the options that the PiCor Corporation faces with that. How has your thinking evolved over the last year?
So we have just recently merged PiCor into Vicor. We did that given evolving needs, opportunities and synergies, also with a view to creating a liquidity opportunity for the Vicor option holders that had made investments in the success of Vicor as a whole for many years. So we've exchanged the Vicor options for Vicor options. We did so mindful of all of the implications of that. So the former PiCor option holders now Vicor option holders. They have restrictions with respect to liquidity. It will start in a year and then progress over the next 5 years. So that's a step that early this year it became clearly needed, and you know, we acted on it as quickly as we could, you know, under the circumstances, given the challenges of, you know, achieving a fair valuation of you know, Paygo as an entity for the purpose of acquiring it from within Vicor. I think it was valued months ago at about $100 million, slightly over $100 million. The Paygo option holders as a whole, Claudio, have, what, 15% of that? 18%.
Single digits are important.
So that's all been converted into, you know, Vicor stock options. And actually, you might have seen, might have seen a couple of down days because Vicor, you know, option holders, you know, at some expiring or soon to be expiring options that they had to exercise and then pay, you know, pay taxes and the exercise price through this position of some shares. Go ahead.
Mr. Petruzzi, just a couple follow-up questions. My hearing's not as what it used to be. When you said the existing factory, did you say that capability for 400 or 500 million?
You know, that's a long-standing problem I have. You know, whenever I say 400, people understand 500. Whenever I say 500, people understand. So when Vicor, leading up to the formation of Vicor, I asked Esty for 400,000, and he understood 500,000. And it's not, I'm telling you the truth. So I still haven't managed to make it clear in English. So I'm sorry, your question was?
Oh, the capacity of the current facility, do you see this?
Let me be clear in a different way. It's, I think, conservatively, $500 million.
Okay, gotcha, $500 million. Gotcha.
Yeah.
And the new space you're looking at is, did I hear 250,000 square feet?
So we were looking last week at lots in the range of 25 to 50 acres onto which we could build. It takes about 25 acres to do 200 feet to 300,000 square feet.
I'm sorry, 250 to what?
To 300,000 square feet.
300,000.
Yeah, that's
okay.
You know.
So that's the amount of expansion you're looking for. And then you said
yeah.
That was within 12 months. Is that breaking ground, or is that when you have?
So again, and I'm emphasizing this because it's very important. You know, given the scale up of capacity, and the need to focus on that. And the fact that we have, you know, new processes and new generations of products, you know, coming to fruition. The priority over the next 12 months is to scale up capacity within our existing facility without having key operational resources get defocused by the new building and the new line and all of that good stuff. So we're going to buy the land, you know, do the planning, and take a series of careful steps to enable the additional capacity, while at the same time putting a lot of emphasis on squeezing out productivity improvements, and there's many to be had, and we have some empty space still within a federal seat, you know, facility. You know, we've been able to repurpose some of the lines. So this is an ongoing level of activity. You know, Barry was involved with some of these things years ago. His successors have mastered this kind of capability. So we can do more with less within existing walls and with less space. And so we're going to milk that to the extent possible before actually buying equipment and installing it into a new facility. The lead time for that is about 6 months. So we can stage all this in such a way that, without running out of runway, we don't end up, getting there prematurely. And
6 months till you buy the land, or 6 months?
No, I think the land is probably going to happen sooner than that. It depends.
You start building
Again, these are still.
I know it's guessing.
Yeah, but my best guesstimate at this point is you'll probably be within six for the land. Then a year after that we'll be in the facility.
Okay, gotcha.
Let's see. This gentleman never got to ask a question earlier, so.
How many shifts are you running? Are you running them 7 days a week?
Yeah, so it depends on the particular product line. So some with some products, it could be one or two shifts. With other products, we have three shifts. Yeah, it depends on the product. So, but we've done this before. We have. The ability to efficiently run on three shifts, and obviously that's part of the capacity flexibility, and I think there are other facets to that. There's a lot of opportunity for expanding capacity of FLC.
What about PyCor? Is it in Provider? They have land there, don't they?
Well, actually, that's the one building that we are leasing, right, Claudia? So that's the only exception. Everything else we own. And that's generally speaking, our preference. But so PyCor recently moved into a new facility. When was it? A year ago? I never visited, so I don't know where it is. Yeah, so you got that much space. Yeah, 23,000 square feet. Yeah.
Would that be an appropriate way of doing things, using their space?
No. That space, and by the way, part of the Vigo population, which is now Vigo, right, is actually in our other building in Andover. So in Andover, we have, I think, about 100,000 square feet. And then the 250,000 square feet, which is the manufacturing space. The 100,000 square feet is primarily office space. Neither that office space nor the PyCor space in Rhode Island would be suitable. I think very likely the new facility is going to be up on 93, within a few exits. Be where Amazon was looking at the possibility of putting a big facility or at some other exit on 93 in New Hampshire. Please.
Can you talk about, it sounds like the MBM is really, I think when you first announced the 48 volt in the data center, it was really sort of a greenfield opportunity because it didn't make sense to have the 12 volt infrastructure that's hard to kind of free engineers. It sounds like MBM really opens up a brownfield opportunity within the data center. Can you talk about those customers' sort of desire or motivation to switch and how quickly that can happen?
Yeah, so as suggested earlier, I think there's a very short-term opportunity to deploy NBMs converting 12 to 48 to power state-of-the-art GPUs within a 12-volt infrastructure. That's going to start late this year. There is a longer-term opportunity for some of the same customers to transition to a 48-volt infrastructure, at which point they could still use the NBM, but now use it in reverse to convert 48 to 12 to continue to use their 12-volt multi-phase point-of-load regulators, short of eventually going to 48-volt for their complete point-of-load solutions. I think all of those are options that customers have and that I think customers are going to exercise. And I think the more conservative ones will take it in the following sequence. Use the NBM 12 to 48 to power a 48-volt load in a 12-volt infrastructure. Transition the 12-volt infrastructure to 48. Could you use the NBM or something like it to convert 48 back to 12 to continue to do on their motherboards the kind of thing they've been doing historically? And maybe for some of their more demanding loads, their AI chips that consume 500 amps or 1,000 amps were the multi-phase solution, which might require 16 phases or 20 phases, runs totally out of gas. They'll start peeling that off and go in factorized power with our building blocks, directly 48 to the point of load. Eventually, I think all of this is going to be based on 48 volt. And the reason, again, has to do with automotive. You know, I remember one of our Japanese customers, this was 10 or 15 years ago, telling me that automotive drives change in electronic systems at large. And that was, I think, a very insightful observation. And it was at a point in time where the electronics content within a vehicle isn't what it is today, and particularly what it's going to be a few years from now, right? Because with more and more electronics in the vehicle, Liam was telling me last night, 5G providing a level of connectivity, you know, from the cloud to the client, the client being potentially a vehicle, and all that goes with that. Those kinds of systems are going to drive standards in the industry at large.
Time for two more questions.
Okay. Please.
I have a two-part question, one about the past and one about the future. I think the company's always been very forward-looking about the technology. Mm-hmm. I think everyone in this room has been very impressed about your vision. What was it that drove adoption and what we saw outsiders as investors and bookings and revenue last year? Mm-hmm. Like, what was the tipping point? And then in the future, what do you see as being potentially the tipping point for adoption of your front-end systems versus point-of-load technology, which had driven the revenues recently?
So I think in a nutshell, some of the concepts were the proverbial concepts before their time. It took visionaries in their own industries, people at Google as an example, to wanna take the risk of doing something that they understood was right, but presented certain challenges or risks, right? So the concept before its time is the explanation for the past. Going to the four part of your question, I think what we're beginning to see now is the complementary risk calculation, which is that once something becomes evident to the industry at large, somebody making decisions for their company in its personal risk assessment has got to ask himself or herself the question, am I at risk by not acknowledging that there's been a change. And that's with respect to industry trends and standards, as well as their perception of VIGO, right? So it's not just that success breeds success as a general statement, but when it comes to risk assessment, I think historically most companies viewed VIGO as a niche supplier of specialty products at expensive prices. There's still many that view us that way. I think it takes time to change these kinds of perceptions. And obviously, there's nothing better than seeing industry leaders, industry pioneers make the change, because subliminally that conveys the right kinds of considerations with respect to going forward. The risk being not adopting what's clearly a better technology and doing so with a company that, you know, is getting to the critical mass that is necessary to support their needs. I mean, there are still potential customers, you know, asking, you know, can you supply the quantity of products we're going to need? That's a question that's coming up, actually, more and more in the context of players in the space, you know, competing with NVIDIA or aspiring to compete with NVIDIA or looking to respond to the growing NVIDIA trend and seeing a need to adopt the kinds of solutions we developed for NVIDIA, being concerned that they may not be able to get enough, or we may not be able to supply those needs. But I think it becomes easier as there is more widespread recognition and a track record of not letting customers down. We have not let customers that have committed to us down. And that's really been the history of the company from the beginning, because even as a small company playing in niche markets with niche type of solutions, we had typically always had single source dependency by each and every customer. There are still a couple, with your permission, there's still a couple of investors, shareholders that haven't asked their questions, so please.
Could you give more color to the rollout as you see an adoption in the auto industry, reaching the point of no return of the power of computing that has got to start happening in 2020?
So what I understand is we are 1.5-2 years away from large-scale deployment of autonomous driving. First, I think, in support of services before individual transportation. The systems are getting to be, and again, the Tesla Autopilot is not representative of that, right? The really sophisticated systems are getting to be good enough for that. And I think competition to enable this on a global scale is making it possible for regulatory constraints to be, you know, addressed in the U.S. You know, by state or potentially, you know, through federal initiatives. Because frankly, you know, if the U.S. were not to keep up with this, you know, the Chinese or Europeans would get, ahead of us in another critical area. So. We see it happening. I think what we're hearing from the companies we work with is that it's 18 months away, And the scale up is going to be pretty big. You know, again, going from, you know, 1,000 cars in a year to tens of thousands relatively quickly. Jeremy in the back.
What's the fourth generation versus the third generation? A couple of questions. So when fourth generation rolls out, would that eventually replace third generation? And the next question is, how does that affect your gross margin profile? Will you give some of that away on pricing to be competitive, to gain share, or just trying to figure out how do I model that going forward?
So the fourth generation will not replace the third in the sense of substituting in existing sockets, because customers, once they develop a solution, obviously they are very much invested in it, and it's not until their next generation of product that they'll make the next choice. So it's really more of a forward prospective type opportunity than retrospective. You know, we still sell products that got designed literally 30 years ago. They still sell, and they're not, you know, it's very hard to make them go away. With respect to the part of your question of what does it mean in terms of component count, performance, cost effectiveness, and margins, and competitive position. So, Clara and I actually were looking last night at some, you know, 4G PRM platforms as compared to older generation, and literally the component count, particularly comparing it to 2G, is dramatic, and you free up large swaths of precious real estate, which reduces component count, increasing density and cost effectiveness and performance. So I think it's a very it's going to be a very significant change. You know, customers are anticipating it. You know, we've projected these benefits. They're looking forward to it in terms of improved efficiency and density. You know, we're looking to get them implemented as quickly as possible. Obviously, there's a necessary sequence to these developments. It's not going to be, you know, my expectation is that our first 4G products in production will not be in production until the middle of next year. And those would be primarily PRM-based systems to also deploy the VTM portion. There's a piece of this also relate to front-end systems, getting front-end systems to much higher level of proficiency, cost effectiveness. That'll probably be the latter part of next year. We're going to have prototypes in the second quarter, about this time next year. But with respect to production, probably that'll be 6 months, 9 months.
And the margins,
will that improve your gross margins? Yes, it will improve our gross margins. Look, our gross margins are going to get better as a result of increasing volumes, irrespective of what particular mix of product is, right? Just because, you know, our cost structure is, it's got still a large component of fixed costs, and, you know, an extra $10 million worth of revenues in a quarter makes a difference in terms of absorbing those fixed costs. But 4G is inherently more cost effective because it's got a higher level of integration, so there's a lot of parts that go away. Please.
Since you didn't have any things to keep you up at night, maybe I might give you one real quick.
Okay.
I was with a company, EMC Corporation,
yeah,
that had explosive growth as you're projecting.
Yeah.
And I was in human resources.
Yeah.
And so my question to you is, do you have the team to take you to the next step? You're going to be growing, you say, in New Hampshire. Where are you going to get the talent to be able to really execute? You know, you have the space, but where are you going to get the people?
Well, so we realize that, you know, we compete for talent just as any other company does. I think the key to competing for talent and being able to attract and retain talent is, you know, having a good culture within the company that appeals to, you know, people that want to make a difference. It's their peers or their next door neighbors telling that, you know, Vigo is a good place to be at. You know, we're doing well. There is opportunity for growth. There is opportunity for options. They're going to be worth more money. All of these things play a role. But, you know, we obviously recognize that human resources are key, and that could be a limiting factor. That's why, among other things, we're focused on that. But I would say that we've done well in that regard. I think our retention has been good, and that bodes well for the purpose of addressing the challenge of attracting more talent in years to come. I will add one comment. I think that just as with the manufacturing equipment and manufacturing infrastructure, we have a lot more opportunity for expanding capacity through productivity enhancements. The same holds true to a high degree on the human resource front with respect to, for instance, engineering talent or applications engineering talent or other key talent in the sense that I think given the level of maturity of the various generations of products and what we've been able to do in terms of subsequent generations of integrations and, you know, bringing subsequent generations of products to markets, we learned how to become more efficient with respect to that part of the challenge. So I don't expect our having to hire people at the rate of the revenue growth of the company. I think it's going to be, at least for a while, you know, a far lesser rate. I think it's there too, a lot more we can do with, you know, the crew we have. I don't think you had a chance to ask.
Very quick. So yeah. ERP systems and IT, you're set to handle expansion with that. Where do you stand with ERP?
Yeah, so I think we may need a refresh on that front at some point in time. I think we have a relatively large information technology team. We actually spend percentage-wise a lot more than many companies in our general space. You know, part of it is we have some unique routines to manage the business or to do data mining with respect to key aspects of you know, sales or operations. So I think we have some talent in the general area. Some of the systems may be getting a little old and may need update at some point in time, but we're not in the midst of any change right this minute. And with that, last question.
Supercomputers, you haven't talked about it. Could you give us an update where you are? Is it on the conference call? You're many of the new supercomputer systems that they reference the IBM and the Power 9. Where you are with them as well.
So I think we're becoming more and more a factor in supercomputing. I think. You know, the second customer is going to be visiting week after next is a customer in that space. It has been a customer of ours at the point of load now for a year and a half using factorized power. They have an interest in the RFM for their next generation system, so that's an opportunity where we may be able to provide the full power system solution going forward. We talked earlier about you know, Paisley and Exascaler and, you know, what we did in Japan. That's obviously an example of, I think it was a top 500, right? You know, supercomputing deployment. I think there's a number of these things going on in China. You know, we have a lot of interest there from the FANGs and, you know, other, the alphabet that is getting more complex and difficult to pronounce. But, you know, just so something 2 days ago, you know, requirement for a artificial intelligence device as part of some supercomputing system where a factorized power solution is key to advancing the capabilities. So I think there's a general perception at this point that when it comes to leading edge computing platforms, Vigo is far and away got the best technology. And the complementary statement is that not adopting a factorized power solution limits the capability to the point where the performance of the end product is handicapped, and we want to have that happen, right? So it's becoming very compelling. And I think, again, I'm repeating myself, potential customers that refrained from wanting to go with us, even though they knew we had, you know, better solutions, are now beginning to view it in a different way, where they have to embrace it and not to be left behind. And if there is nothing else, thanks very much again.
Thank you.